This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, January 4th. I'm John Wanamaker. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis is expecting stronger growth for the state's economy in 2013, Annie Baxter reports.
After looking at statistical models and surveying business owners, the Fed's economists are expecting Minnesota's unemployment rate to drop to 4.7% by year's end. And they think employers in the state will add about 59,000 jobs, which would mean a robust rate of job growth. But Fed economist Rob Grunewald says wages probably won't improve much. He says business leaders expect to boost wages by a modest 2-3%.
As companies offer a position, they're still getting a number of applications, and that's not going to drive up those wage rates broadly at this point.
However, Grunewald says industries such as healthcare, information technology, and manufacturing are experiencing some wage pressure as competition for qualified workers stiffens.
That's our business reporter, Annie Baxter. In other news, Target sales last month fell a bit short of analyst expectations, but as Martin Moylan reports, the retailer says fourth quarter earnings will meet or possibly beat the low end of a prior forecast.
The discount retailer says sales at stores open at least a year were basically flat for the 5 weeks that ended December 29th. Analysts had expected an increase of about 1%. Edward Jones retail analyst Brian Yarbrough says Target was smart not to cut prices aggressively to boost sales.
They did a good job of, you know, balancing price investments and driving sales. And, you know, while sales didn't grow much on a comparable store basis, at least they weren't very overly promotional, which then pressured margins. So they did a good job of balancing that.
The strongest sales category during the month was food, with health and beauty and clothing also doing well. Total December sales at Target's some 1,800 stores rose slightly to $10.2 billion.
That's our reporter, Marty Moylan. Republican State Representative Steve Gottwalt has announced he'll resign from the Minnesota legislature. Tom Scheck has the story.
Gottwalt announced his resignation in an email to his colleagues. He recently accepted a lobbying job with the Center for Diagnostic Imaging of St. Louis Park. Gottwalt initially planned to lobby in other states to avoid a conflict of interest in Minnesota, but he said his new position will make it too difficult to represent his constituents in the St. Cloud area. Gottwalt was also criticized for becoming a health insurance broker while serving as chair of the House Health and Human Services Policy Committee. Governor Dayton will have to call a special election to fill Gottwalt's seat. He's the second lawmaker to announce plans to resign after being elected and before the 2013 legislative session begins next week. DFL Representative Terry Morrow of St. Peter announced last month that he's resigning to take a position in Chicago. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
And Tim Pugmire reports on a new study from the nonprofit Center for Rural Policy and Development. It warns that rural Minnesota is losing its influence at the state capitol.
The study points out that fewer Minnesotans have ties to rural life or an understanding of the rural economy. It also found that influential statewide organizations are increasingly focused on the Twin Cities and regional centers. Brad Finstead, executive director of the Center for Rural Policy and Development, said the report is aimed at highlighting rural concerns ahead of the start of the legislative session next week.
We're kind of at that tipping point. You know, you look at the redistricting and the representation. I mean, I think now we're probably a deficit in seats. And so it's important that we do a good job of educating our brothers and sisters in the metro area.
Finstead, who's a former Republican state representative, said the report also challenges rural organizations to collaborate better on key issues such as education, transportation, and health care. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Officials at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources say they've decided on the best method to keep invasive Asian carp from traveling up the Mississippi River, and it isn't an electric barrier. Rupa Shenoy reports.
The voracious Asian carp may be the biggest threat to the health of the Mississippi River and to northern Minnesota fishing. But the most effective way to keep carp from moving upstream has too many drawbacks for state officials. The DNR's Ecological and Waters Resources Director, Steve Hirsch, explained the problem to reporters in a conference call.
In general, electricity or electric barriers are considered to be the most effective deterrent barrier technology, but they also have significant public safety risks.
The urgency to mount defenses to Asian carp escalated when, in October, the National Park Service said it had discovered silver carp DNA near Lock and Dam No. 1, which is just south of Ford Parkway, between Highland Park in St. Paul and the Minnehaha neighborhood in Minneapolis. The DNR commissioned a report to study the best way of keeping Asian carp out of the upper Mississippi. The consulting firm Barr Engineering ruled out closing Lock and Dam No. 1 since it's used by recreational and commercial boats and barges and would require an act of Congress to close. Hirsch says the best option left is technology that combines bubbles, lights, and noise to deflect Asian carp, but it's hard to say how effective it will be.
The long and short of it is that any type of technology, any type of deterrent barrier, Lock and Dam 1 would have to be considered experimental because it's just so different from the other areas where this type of strategy has been used.
Hirsch says that, compared to other fish, Asian carp are really sensitive to sound. The technology would create noise tuned to a frequency that carp hear best. The bubbles would look like a barrier to fish, and the bright flashing lights would just add to the annoyance. Faced with that assault, the DNR hopes Asian carp will swim in the opposite direction, toward the main river channel. Hirsch says the wall of bubbles, lights, and sound wouldn't have to span the entire river because the dam itself is an effective barrier.
The fact that you only need to deflect and not block passage across the entire river channel is an advantage to using this type of a strategy. And then we also have the Coon Rapids Dam upstream, which is a physical barrier that, while it in and of itself is not 100%, is a fairly effective fish barrier that we hope in combination with the deterrent barrier will be effective.
Hirsch says construction of the bubble barrier could cost as little as $12 million or as much as $19 million, with annual maintenance costs of up to $250,000. If the funds come through, Hirsch says construction could start in mid to late November and be completed by March 2014. But first, the plan needs approval from the Army Corps of Engineers, which operates the dam. The Corps' Colonel Michael Price says they'll try to make the process as fast as possible.
This one in particular has got senior leader interest, so that'll help it move along through the process better. But it is unique, hasn't been done at any other structure in the Corps, so that will tweak some interest along the process.
The superintendent of the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, Paul Labovitz, says he's glad the DNR has an aggressive timeline, but it may be too optimistic.
I remember back to some of the meetings in the governor's office where the Army Corps said it would take potentially up to 4 years to conduct their environmental reviews, and to have those reviews underway and even done by this fall, apparently they can act a little quicker.
As long as the DNR is taking action, Whitney Clark of the conservation group Friends of the Mississippi River says he's happy. But he says no one should think of the bubble barrier as a complete solution to the Asian carp problem.
People will think that this solves the problem. And we don't really need to do anything. Look, we've spent $15 million or $18 million or whatever it's going to be on this. And isn't that problem taken care of already? You know, I don't think we can afford to take that approach to this.
Clark says it will take more research to understand how to control the Asian carp.
That's reporter Rupa Shenoy. The 113th Congress convened yesterday. The previous Congress was marked by high-stakes confrontations between Republicans who control the House and Democrats in the Senate and the Obama administration. Washington reporter Brett Neely checked in with Minnesota's congressional delegation to see what their hopes for the new Congress are.
It was a day of pomp, ceremony, and optimism on Capitol Hill. Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar was sworn into a second term by Vice President Joe Biden.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that we will support and defend the Constitution?
Across the rotunda, the House began its session by electing a speaker, the first chance for Democrat Rick Noland to vote on the House floor since he last served 32 years ago.
Noland.
Nancy Pelosi.
Pelosi.
Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann kept things suspenseful by missing her vote at first. That initially left Speaker John Boehner a few votes short of what he needed to return to the post. Eventually, Bachmann made her way into the chamber and cast the 218th ballot for Boehner, who's not popular among all conservative Republicans these days, for allowing the fiscal cliff deal to get a vote a few days ago. The big question on everyone's mind from both parties is whether this Congress will be more productive than the last one. For her part, Klobuchar is optimistic.
As Abraham Lincoln once said,
You must think anew and act anew, and this is our opportunity.
She pointed to much of the major legislation that did pass in the previous Congress, including the fiscal cliff deal, and noted that most of it emerged first from the traditionally rule-bound and slow-moving Senate.
We may not always agree on the solutions, but we have spent a lot of time in the Senate working together, Democrats, Republicans, to at least have a common ground to agree on what the problems are.
Fourth District Congresswoman Betty McCollum, a Democrat, pointed to the fiscal cliff vote, where 85 Republicans joined 172 Democrats to prevent tax hikes on most Americans while raising them on the wealthy, as a sign that perhaps the fierce partisanship of the past 2 years was ebbing.
I'm very optimistic, though, after this last vote, when we saw moderate Republicans working with moderate Democrats to really put together a package that put America first.
From across the aisle, Republican Congressman Eric Paulson said he thought the Ways and Means Committee he sits on would be able to craft a bipartisan tax overhaul plan with the Senate. Doing so, Paulson said, could be a way of returning Congress to a state of normalcy that hasn't existed there for several years.
That will move us away from these Washington quick fixes and 2 month, you know, having a new cliff to more long-term solutions. And that can be a tough and arduous task, but that is the direction that we do need to head.
Paulson's GOP colleague, 2nd District Congressman John Klein, said that as the chairman of the House Education Committee, he still hoped to take care of unfinished business from last term, like rewriting the No Child Left Behind law and making changes to federal student loans. But Klein said that work won't begin right away because Congress has a few more fiscal time bombs to defuse, including raising the nation's borrowing limit, addressing automatic spending cuts that kick in 2 months from now, and crafting a government spending bill that lasts through the end of October.
So those are huge battles, frankly, and there will be battles because we have major differences in our approach of how to fix those. Those are going to dominate almost everything that happens up until the end of March.
The longest-serving member of the state's delegation, DFL Congressman Colin Peterson, said he thinks the rancor of the fiscal cliff deal will carry into this new Congress.
It's going to be ugly. You think this was a problem? Wait till 2 months from now.
Peterson spent much of the last 2 years working on a new farm bill, only to see it be ignored by Republican leaders in the Obama administration in the fiscal cliff agreement. He said he won't do it again unless he gets written assurances it be allowed to come to the floor for a vote.
Why would I go start trying to write another bill if we're going to get put in the same position as we were last year?
Instead, Peterson said he plans to focus his efforts on areas where he thinks some bipartisan cooperation might still be possible, such as oversight of the food stamp program. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
And staying in Washington, D.C., authorities have announced the results of an international crackdown on predators who own, trade, and produce child pornography. The so-called Operation Sunflower, led by Homeland Security investigations, resulted in the arrest of 245 people and the rescue of 123 children, most of them in the United States. Investigators cracked one of the cases here in Minnesota, which led to the arrest of an Illinois woman who is now serving a 25-year sentence in federal prison. Sasha Eslanian reports.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director John Morton called the operation significant but grim. For a 5.5-week period late last year, Homeland Security investigations worked with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and local and international law enforcement partners to target pedophiles who photographed or videotaped their acts and distributed them over the Internet. They rescued children from 19 states and 6 countries. No Minnesota children were rescued, but 2 Minnesota men were arrested. A Stearns County man was arrested in early November, and Nathan Severson of Rochester will serve a 15-year sentence for distributing child pornography. Authorities rescued 44 children directly from their abusers. Morton said the remaining 79 either were exploited by people living outside their homes, or they were abused years ago and are now adults, yet their photos continue to circulate on the Internet.
Sadly, some of the children were very young. For example, we rescued 5 children who were between the ages of 2 and 3. 9 children were between the ages of 4 and 6. 21 were between the ages of 7 and 9.
Agents looked for clues in the online images that would help them locate where and when the crimes took place. Operation Sunflower gets its name from a 2011 case when a distinctive sunflower on a rural Kansas highway sign helped agents track down an 11-year-old girl whose attack was being planned by a teen pedophile. One of the cases highlighted today was solved by vacation photos taken at a resort in northern Minnesota. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children had photographs of an adult woman sexually abusing a girl, but it was the non-abuse photos of the two that provided the clue to the pair's identity. The Homeland Security agent in Bloomington who cracked the case works undercover, so NPR News agreed not to use his name.
They were entitled MN Trip, and in the background of these pictures, there was it showed cabins and an adult female and a juvenile female holding up some fish.
The agent contacted Explore Minnesota, the tourism site, and an employee there knew the resort in the photograph. The agent says the resort owners remembered the vacationers.
Even before the photo hit the table, one of the owners stated, oh, I know who this is. In fact, they actually had their own photographs in a Polaroid album of this family. So it was kind of a shock because they kept in contact with them even when they weren't staying at the resort.
The adult in the photo, Ann Piper of Peoria, Illinois, is now serving 25 years in federal prison for her involvement in the production and distribution of child pornography. And ICE officials say the girl is safe with family members. At today's news conference, John Ryan with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children said, to date, the center's child victim identification program has helped identify 5,000 children featured in abusive images and videos. Ryan says most victims are abused by someone they know.
We know that there's more work to be done. As you've heard, so many of these children have yet to be identified. Anyone could know these victims, these children, and they are relying on all of us to help them.
Homeland Security Investigations is asking for the public's help in three ongoing investigations and released photos today of three adult suspects agents are trying to identify.
That's reporter Sasha Aslanian. Next year, downtown St. Paul will look quite different, and that's not just because its sole department store will be gone. Yes, Macy's will have long disappeared, but by 2014, downtown will see a new grocery store, light rail trains, and the beginnings of a new ballpark. Yet some wonder if all these changes will truly revitalize the downtown's core. Laura Ewan reports.
St. Paul business leaders admit that the official news of Macy's closing was like a kick to the gut. They saw it coming, but it still hurt. Yet Mayor Chris Coleman is quick to put the closure in perspective. He says for all the fond memories that longtime residents have of shopping at downtown department stores, that's not the future.
Waxing nostalgic about how downtown St. Paul used to be in 1940 is missing the point of what downtown St. Paul is going to look like in 2020.
Coleman says Macy's was no longer a destination that drew people to the area. What does bring people to the city's core, he says, are the places that can't be found at a suburban shopping mall. He constantly raves about his favorite downtown menswear store, Jaime's Haberdashery, where you can get tailored suits as well as a clean shave. Coleman says that's where downtown is heading.
If you're going to go into a downtown, you want something that's unique. You want something that you can't get anywhere else.
Coleman's office has already recruited music venues, bars, and niche shops that are fueling a small revival. And next year, there's more to come. Light rail trains on the Green Line will start rolling. Construction of the regional ballpark in Lower Town will be well underway. And a Lund's grocery could finally open by the end of this year, along with more than 250 apartments on top of it. Even developers of other housing projects are excited by what a full-service grocery store will mean for the neighborhood. Clint Blazer is one of the investors reshaping the vacant Pioneer Endicott office buildings into high-end apartments.
A lot of the kids I talk to that live downtown right now, the only reason they even have a car is to run out Robert Street to Cub Foods or Rainbow to get groceries. I think with ones coming, maybe we'll get some more more competition in that area downtown, too.
Blazer says a critical mass of residents, from young professionals to empty nesters, is finally paying dividends for downtown. City planners say about 8,500 people live there, an increase of 28% over 12 years. But what is the role of government in developing its vision? The city has raised some eyebrows by taking over the grocery and apartments project known as a Penfield. Many say in an ideal world, such developments should be built by the private sector. Today's economy, however, is far from ideal, says Matt Kramer, president of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. With some reservations, Kramer applauds the city for jumpstarting the project after the housing market collapsed.
I think all of us were growing tired of seeing the Penfield sign that said, coming this fall, and you're sitting there mentally counting and going, let's see, one, two, oh yeah, it's been 7 years of coming this fall.
Yet it's not hard to find long-timers pining for the old downtown St. Paul, and you don't need to look farther than the mayor's own family.
Well, I'm Nick Coleman. I am a longtime St. Paul resident, a native.
Nick Coleman is a journalist, former newspaper columnist, and the older brother of Mayor Coleman. He says the core of downtown is a dead zone where city leaders once promised vibrancy, and he's not ashamed to say he misses the downtown department stores.
I just find like there's too much emphasis on cool night spots and hipsters and music, and not enough really for the residents, the taxpayers, the longtime suffering citizens of the city. I'm 62 years old, and I get offended when people act like, well, the St. Paul you remember is, that's really the long distant past. It'll never be like the 1930s again. Hey, I wasn't here then either.
Coleman says St. Paul has to be more than a place where hipsters can buy posters or earbuds. He says now that St. Paul has gotten the glitter, it's time to rebuild its core. City planners say they don't know how long it will take to redevelop the Macy's site. When light rail trains begin to cruise down Cedar Street next year, they could roll past an exciting new offering or just an empty shell. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, January 4th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.